From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a series of new polls from America's battleground states, and the news, frankly, was very good for President Trump. The polls were conducted by Siena and the New York Times, and here's Nate Cohn from the Times explaining the big picture now. Quote, "The president is better positioned in the battleground states than he is nationwide and remains really competitive in the states likeliest to decide the election." End quote. The six battleground states are Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, and North Carolina. Trump splits the six states with Senator Sanders. He leads Warren in three states while tying two and trailing one. And against Biden, Trump leads only one of the states. Now, that's good news for Vice President Biden's campaign and for centrists who say that Democrats need to move to the middle. Here's John Chait writing for New York Magazine this week in a piece titled "Democratic Candidates Have Been Living in a Fantasy World." Quote, "In 2018, Democratic candidates waded into hostile territory and flipped 40 House districts, many of them moderate or conservative in their makeup. In almost every instance, their formula centered on narrowing their target profile by avoiding controversial positions and focusing obsessively on Republican weaknesses, primarily Donald Trump's abuses of power and attempts to eliminate health insurance for millions of Americans. The Democratic presidential field has largely abandoned that model, working from the premise that the country largely agrees with them on everything already, or that agreeing with the majority of voters on issues is not even necessary to win, and the campaign has proceeded in blissful unawareness of the extremely high chance that Trump will win again." End quote. 1 year from the next election, it's not just the Democrats are divided, it's a stark generational divide. Older Democrats want Biden or a centrist, and their top priority, they say, is returning Washington to a state of normalcy. Young Democrats want Warren or Sanders, generally speaking, and their top priority is remaking the state of politics as we know it, not going back to how things used to be. It's Election Day. This hour, we are not electioneering. We are not talking 2019. You can join us on WXXI tonight at 9 p.m. for live coverage of local elections. But now we look ahead to 2020 and, frankly, a look at division among the Democrats with our guests in studio. Paul Hippolyte is a political strategist back with us. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's voting day, so obviously my adrenaline is through the roof. I'm ready.
You're ready for this. Patrick Goyle is here. He is I'm going to call you a political organizer.
Yeah, that's fair. Right now I'm a field director for Citizen Action in New York, so you just had my boss on last hour.
It's no pressure for you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here.
Good to be back.
Also with us is Elaine Spall, who is a soon-to-be ex-member of Rochester City Council. How's that feel?
It feels okay. And I'm also thinking that I'm here because I'm the older Democrat. We've gone through this before, but that's okay. I'm the voice of reason. Tonight.
You're not the old.
Today.
The voice of reason. Well, you know what? You're someone who has been warning from the beginning, hey, we can be idealistic, but we may have to be careful.
Yeah.
We've got to win.
We've got to win.
And now John Chait is basically saying you were right.
John's John's my new guy. But listen.
Are you right?
Those of us who are, I don't want to be right, but I think I might be. So here, well, I sort of do, most of the time I do want to be right, but here's my problem. Those of us who think of ourselves as progressive, who have pushed policies and progressive issues forward at the city and in the work that we do across, whether it's programming or the kind of relationships, now are saying don't forget about the middle, and it's painful to be right in this case. We have to ask ourselves, what is our job? What is our job in the next presidential election? What is our job? And so as much as I don't want to be right, you know, I was sort of vilified because I said probably a year ago, maybe not a year ago, Elizabeth Warren is probably not going to be the person who takes us over the edge with Trump. And I got some sort of like backlash because people thought I didn't like women elected to office. You know, that's not true. I have been one for 12 years. It was a low blow I took. I get a lot of low blows. I'm okay.
That's woke culture.
Yeah, right, exactly. But the point is that, right. But the point is that we have a job to do and we must do it well. And I think there was a folk singer here last night. It was awesome at Good Luck. And he had a song talking about, it said, don't forget about the middle. And the middle is not the place we want to go, but we may need to be really clear about what it means to not forget about the middle.
Well, the youngest in the room is Patrick Coyle.
My hair's the grayest, though.
Your hair is the grayest, but you are the youngest. It's a fascinating little bifurcation there. So the actual polling, as I mentioned, people, Democrats over the age of 65, they want Biden around 40%. Democrats under the age of 35, Biden polls less than Andrew Yang.
Yeah, I mean, down there with Tulsi and Steve Bullock.
He is. He's down there with like John Delaney and like all the other white guys that no one can name. It's really interesting. So what's going on in your cohort here that you're so anti-Biden, and have you moved at all?
Paul's like a year older than me. I just want this on the record.
Paul is the distinguished middle statesman.
He's wearing a suit jacket on the radio.
It's the radio. They can't see. I'm wearing a suit jacket too.
So what's going on in your age cohort here?
I think I've talked about this when I've been on the show in the past. It's just, you know, the structural forces of American life have really, you know, sort of moved, and not, you know, because of specific policy decisions, to make life pretty unaffordable for people who are coming out of college and have been in the past 10 years. And I think people look at the policies that, you know, Joe Biden, you know, the people who like worked in like solid union jobs, you know, all throughout the 60s and 70s, and were like, okay, like you have a high school degree, but you can work really hard. Like, yeah, like you can have a solid 3-bedroom house in the suburbs and, you know, put your kids through college. And that social contract just completely gone, you know, and there's candidates who seem to realize that, and there's candidates who don't. And it's clear the solutions and the policies they're proposing, some of them do want to tackle those big structural factors and, you know, try to raise wages, you know, and some of them just are like, hey, you know, remember when Obama was president and we liked him? We're going to do that. And so I think there's a clear divide. But yeah, it's the return to normalcy versus the structural changes.
But looking at those six battleground states, are you moved?
No, because, I mean, we did this all in 2016, right? Where they were like, okay, like, you know, we have to nominate a centrist, you know, like it's a sure win, but we can't get too risky. And that didn't work either. You know, nobody knows anything. Like, and I think there's this really dangerous thing where, you know, voters think as pundits, you know, and you don't vote for who inspires you and, you know, whose policies you agree with the most, but you vote for, you know, some imagined third party and what they think and, you know, what you think they want. And that just does not, you know, that's a way to get like a candidate who doesn't have a really defined base for me.
All right. So Paul Hippolyte, the reason I wanted Paul is because Paul has been steadfast, at least for a while. I don't know if you've wrote it on your steadfastness that we're not going to have an infighting. We're not going to have this circular firing squad. We're not going to take out our candidate before our candidate is even the nominee. And that whatever the choice is, we've got to come together. Are you still there? And do these polls now make you say, okay, it's got to be one way or the other now?
I'm 100% still there. And I know that Jack Dorsey said there was going to be no more political ads on Twitter. But that still has not convinced me to go back to Twitter. I have my account open, but I stay off of it because of the absurdity of people on the left, of this idea that either you're 100% with me or you're awful. And we can't go on like this. It's just, it's not real. It's disingenuous. And I think they're not only scaring off their own voters, but people that they could persuade that they want nothing to do with them because they're so obnoxious. And it's almost like there were a few Bernie bros in 2016, and now they've become like almost all of Twitter, at least.
Now, careful here. You just used the term Bernie bros, and Bernie could be your candidate.
And if Bernie's the candidate, we're going to do whatever we can to win. But what you can't do is then say he's the savior and everything he says is right, and there's no if, ands, or. But here's a good example. One of my really good friends from Vermont, she is one of the I've met her on working on campaigns. Brilliant person. And she was saying how she does not agree with the Medicare for All. Part of that being, she said, look, if there's a new regime in place and they decide, we don't like, we don't think women's reproductive rights should be protected or contraceptive or contraceptives. Or I know there's a new thing going through the health administration right now, and they're talking about, I'm going to get it wrong, but basically not covering PrEP and yep, anti-HIV right, medicines.
Yep.
Like, you can go down the list of things that you can imagine that could potentially be in the crosshairs if you have an administration that you don't like, and so, or that doesn't agree with you. And so these are complicated issues, and to make it seem like you're either for Medicare for All or you're not a real Dem or you're not a real progressive, that's just nonsense. There are so many different ways that we can live, and we need to focus on the bigger picture and decide that, okay, getting Trump out of office is our number one goal. And beyond that, there's so many different ways to cut the cake.
All right, so a couple of things there, though. Number one, it sounds like you agree with President Obama and his comments last week about the idea that, and look at Patrick's already got your hands over your face.
Poor Patrick's in angst. You can't see him. He's on the
Patrick doesn't think cancel culture is a thing.
He's fallen off his chair.
President Obama does, and he's kind of tired of it. Do you agree with him?
Yeah. Gosh, yes. And as I said, for me, it's more of the fact that not everyone agrees with me right now. I don't agree with myself from 2 years ago. So this idea that I'm so right and so, that anyone
so,
that,
so
that is...
2 years ago, you is canceled?
In some ways.
2017,
yeah.
Paul Hippolyte
is
so canceled.
But I believe in evolution. I think most Democrats do, right? We grow and we evolve and you're presenting with new facts and you change. And this idea that you are absolutely right and someone that doesn't agree with you 100%, they're terrible and we got to move on from them. It's like, check yourself again in 5 years. You're going to disagree. Mm-hmm. So be a little bit more humble and a little bit more generous to others and allow them space to get to where you are.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying. And what you're saying is we can't just be purity test and the only one candidate can do this. But right now the polls are showing that certain candidates are faring better than others in the roughly 6 states that matter. I mean, Trump could lose the popular vote and probably he's almost certain to lose the popular vote. He could lose it by 5 or 6 million and still win easily in the Electoral College if things don't change there. Have you moved at all? Do these polls tell you, hey, we have to support whoever the nominee is, but let's move to the middle?
The reason why I'm going to say no, it's a little bit too early.
Okay.
I think there's still a large number of voters that are not paying attention yet. I've been paying attention since 2016, even I need a break sometimes. But most voters are not paying attention. You're talking about the most educated or maybe at least the most intentional voters are the ones that are currently engaged. And
so
I think that's going to, it's going to change. And like Elizabeth Warren, so many people don't know who she is yet. They don't know a lot of her. They don't know a lot of her positions.
So that's,
there hasn't been $1 billion spent defining her yet. Mm-hmm. And so most people, they heard of her from Pocahontas and they're like, yeah, she seems a little disingenuous or she doesn't seem like she's straightforward or whatever it is. And that's going to change over time. Biden's numbers are what they are because he's been around so long that people already have a defined image of him. And Bernie's getting to that point. So I think the bad news for Bernie is that he might be hitting his ceiling, where I think Elizabeth Warren's ceiling is a lot higher. So I think there's potential that she can go a lot higher than even Biden can at this point. And she will move a little bit to the center once this primary is done.
But she could win the election next year.
Of course she could win the election. Yeah, she's running against Donald Trump.
Okay, so so Patrick, on that subject of Warren, because I know you're much more happily in the Warren camp than maybe some of your other Democratic colleagues. Nate Cohn from the New York Times offered an interesting analysis, the first that I have heard of this. His data read so far is that right now 6% of the American electorate would vote for Biden but not Warren. He said there's essentially no, it doesn't go the other way. Warren voters would reluctantly vote for Biden if Biden's the nominee. 6% of the American electorate would vote Biden, not Warren. And so he was asked why. He divides it into 3 groups. First, he says a third of that group, so 2% of the electorate, doesn't know much about Warren and is open to change. Exactly what Paul just said. Second, he says about a third of that group, another 2%, thinks Warren is too politically extreme. They want a safe moderate like Biden who will keep things mostly the same in Washington. Finally, he says about a third of that group describe themselves as Democrats, but they find women in politics not very likable. They hold rather conservative views on social issues. They prefer male candidates. They think white people face as much discrimination as people of color in this country. And they think Biden understands that while Warren does not. So it's an interesting group.
Who are they?
That's a tough question. I don't know what you want me to do with that.
What I'm asking
call a psychologist.
Call a psychologist. What I'm asking you is... Is the candidate you support, are we too misogynistic a country to go in that direction?
I don't think so. I don't. You know, I mean, I just, you know, you can't tell me there's more people that dislike Elizabeth Warren than dislike Hillary Clinton. And you can flip 75,000 voters in 3 states and, you know, Hillary Clinton's president. You know, I just, and with 4 years of Trump, you know, it's always easier to run as the change agent than to run as the incumbent. And, you know, I just, you know, I don't see... I mean, like, undoubtedly America has a huge misogyny problem, right? And that would be one of the biggest issues in her campaign to deal with. But no, I think that wouldn't prevent her from winning at all. I don't.
Well, Elaine, then on the subject of, well, you want to weigh in on that part?
Yeah,
go ahead.
You know, I'm just, first of all, you guys are, I'm so glad that this new generation is coming behind us. Not behind you because you're still young.
No, behind, they're behind me.
Behind me. And I'm grateful for that. But
I'm the middleman here.
You know, one of the things that I think is really, the new, there's a new New York Times, the Obama's financial guy, was like, Elizabeth Warren will ruin this country. And he's a progressive Democrat under Obama. And it's because of the numbers of policies and practices she's going to put in place, extreme, right away. First of all, she won't. But I don't think she's also a campaign promise person. I think she really believes in the New Green Deal and all that stuff. I really don't know if it's misogyny or it is a particular kind of style. I do think Elizabeth Warren is more electable than Hillary. I can't believe I'm saying that because I said the opposite a couple, maybe 6 months ago.
Well, she's a better campaigner than Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely.
She's much more authentic. And, you know, and again, we know Hillary. We like her as a human being. But she, I think Elizabeth Warren is more electable. So I will say that.
Okay. Can I add to that? It's because
sure.
Part of it is maybe because she's new. So yeah. Obama was relatively new.
Yes.
Bill was relatively new.
Yes.
I mean, we have this thing of we want the new, the fresh, the shiny new toy.
Every president since H.W. Bush has been running like, vote for me to
the change.
Fix Washington.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She seems more authentic, too. She seems a little bit less measured, and she seems a little bit just more authentic and mm-hmm. more real. And I think more, I think that even women who are saying, I'm not sure about, I don't know who those people are. That's an interesting demographic.
Oh, I believe they exist.
We don't know. I don't think any of us know them, but maybe they exist. If you're listening, don't identify yourself. But, you know, I just think we know that we have right now politics built on fear. And that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit.
It's well, I think you've been reading my script. did you steal my notes?
Collusion.
Megan, did you say? No.
I'm going to read something.
No, let me say what I was first.
I'm going to go
your Donna,
you on this.
Who is your Donna Brazile?
You led into this. You're right. This is the point. Exactly the point you're making is people like former Obama administration officials. They're the ones warning against Elizabeth Warren
right now. Right.
Michael Bloomberg's money manager. They're saying Elizabeth Democrats on Wall Street.
Right.
Progressive titan Michael Bloomberg. So, the ninth richest man in the world.
Okay, well, hold on.
It's not just him.
Hold
Patrick.
On, though.
It's
let me,
I know,
let
I know.
Me read. So this is what author Anand Giridharadas was writing this week on the rift within the Democratic Party. He writes that in the last week alone, Wall Street Dems have come out with warnings against some against Sanders, mostly against Warren. And they are former Obama officials, money managers, big money Democrats. Here's what Giridharadas writes in response to all this. I want your take on this.
Okay.
Here's what he says. Quote, in the coming months, Democrats will have an opportunity to end the era of neoliberalism or market fundamentalism. And in the coming months, we are going to see a desperate effort by not Republicans, but Democratic plutocrats to scare us into not doing it. Mm-hmm. The people who have caused our biggest problems are not the solution to our problems. Mm-hmm. The people with the most to lose from real change are telling us that change is too dangerous, which means we're moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We have to keep going when they say stop. That's why all the anti-Sanders and anti-Warren warnings from the plutocrats are beautifully counterproductive. They should be guides on what to do for us. They are disguised as guides as what not to do. The truth is, if you manage Mike Bloomberg's money and do so in an age of plutocracy and life-shortening inequality, what is good for you and what is good for the country are, at this moment, opposites. So whatever you think should not happen probably should. End quote. What do you think?
So, and that's the kind of thing. So here's the thing. We have fear on both sides, though, too. So liberals are so scared because our human rights are at risk. You think about, you know, Paul was talking about some policies coming out. Right now, for example, if you have an HHS grant, the Trump administration is saying you cannot serve LGBT youth. You can't provide them medical care. This is scary stuff. So you have liberals who are frightened to death. And now you have sort of reasonable Democrats that you sort of admire and think have done good work. Not the plutocrats. I got that. But they're also saying, be careful, be careful, be careful, because she, Elizabeth Warren, will completely devastate the economy as we know it. And at the end of the day, it won't be better for the people we're trying to protect, Democrats. So you've got fear. It is the first time in my memory, and I'm aging, but I have good memory. He doesn't say I'm getting old. I say it myself. But you have, for the first time in my memory, a whole universe built on fear. The fear of losing health care, the fear of not being able to provide child care, the fear of not having PrEP, the fear of having your housing taken away, the fear. And now we've got reasonable Democrats who we love because they were part of our beloved Obama camp telling us be careful. So what value is that message? That's what I want to ask you. What value is that message? We want to be progressive, but we don't want to risk it all. And so how do you, you know, it reminds me of wanting your children to be like grow and, you know, jump off things and be brave, and then also saying don't do that. At the same time, how do we balance this?
So let me follow up with one question before I turn to Patrick, whose head may blow off his neck
no.
in a moment here.
But hold on. That's a perfectly reasonable take.
But Elaine, if it were Mitt Romney in the White House, would you feel more compelled to say, let's go for it? Geir Dadas is right. Running to the center.
I think so.
This is a national emergency and you cannot risk
it? I think we have a critical job in front of us. We cannot. As someone said, we might be able to come back from 4 years. We can't come back from 8 years. And what will happen, what will continue, because every day we see a little bit more like after human rights more than anything. And there was a film in the Women's Film Festival, Condor and the Eagle, that talks about the Amazon and what's happening in the environment. It's freaking scary. If you have children, I have grandchildren, it is so scary. And you just see whatever it is, whatever it's climate change, environment, healthcare. I don't think we can come back from 8 years of this. I think it will be with such, because it'll be a second term and you won't have anything to worry about, right? So all the gloves are off. And that's what I think. I think if it was a more moderate, I mean, Bush Jr. looks good to us. That's compared, boy. Come on, boys. Compared.
I mean, has Trump started any wars on false?
All right, never mind. Okay, never mind.
Civilians?
Okay, let's ignore them for a second. No, let's ignore them. But they're like groaning. But
he hangs out with Ellen. Okay, everything's fine.
I know.
George Bush is canceled.
And he's
yes, I agree with that.
Listen,
hold on. Let Elaine finish.
He's a painter now. He's a painter. He's painting portraits of all these people. But I think that. There are policies that are human rights devastations that maybe the Bush era had as well. But I think with two terms of what we have right now, and obviously I'm very liberal, people know who I am, I'm really worried for our children.
Okay, Patrick.
I really am.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a perfectly reasonable take. You know, there's just a disagreement about where Trump comes from. But, you know, one quick point. You know, Obama did campaign pretty progressive, but in particular, his financial people, Treasury secretaries, Fed Reserve boards, governed pretty centrist to outright conservative, right? Like Tim Geithner refused to prosecute any bank executives during the foreclosure crisis. They cared much more about making sure the banks. So I'm not sure I would really describe any of the people who worked on Obama's financial side as like really like, you know, progressive titans, right? And also, like, you know, the policy that all these Wall Street guys are freaking out about is the wealth tax, you know? And that's universally widely popular among all political spectrums, no matter what, right? Like a 2% tax on every dollar over $50 million or whatever it is. I think something like 63% of Republicans are in favor of that idea. So I just think it's important to note those two things. And then also, you know, I think this is just, you know, whether you think Trump is a once-in-a-generation anomaly or a logical consequence of the past 40 years of the conservative movement, you know, and I understand the desire to, you know, just be like, all right, we got to take the first person to get him out. You know, if, you know, you think that like as soon as Trump's out of the White House, you know, things will just go back to normal and, you know, like Joe Biden will just be, you know, wearing aviators and eating ice cream, you know, on the lawn again. But, you know, so I think we're just back to, you know, the opening conversation, whether it's, you know, normalcy versus, you know, versus the American society needs big structural changes.
And you want that structural change.
I do. But I understand if people don't. And I'll vote for whoever the nominee is.
I'm not even sure that Elaine doesn't. I think Elaine is so scared you can have neither.
Right. Yeah. You see, and one of the things, and I actually, I'm admiring Patrick because he's what we need. And so is Paul coming next. The notion that we have a level of incivility under this administration, I mean, really evil incivility in the way it presents, and I'll give you an example. I'm renovating a small house in a neighborhood on the Southwest for LGBT young people who are homeless, right? And our fire safety woman from the state came in and she said, what kind of a security system will you have? I said, well, I have fire security and all that stuff. And she said, I'm worried that you have a neighborhood, you have a targeted demographic here that could be targeted under some of the things we're seeing across this country. That never happened before. I'm not saying that LGBT young people were not targeted one by one, but for a state official to bring that to my attention, we are living in an incivil, uncivil world, and he's made it worse. On city council, people have said things, come to speak to us in ways they never did before. shame on you language, I mean, emails. So I worry as much about the soul of our country. And I'm not saying George Bush was, you know, full of goodwill. But there is a lack of civility that I think is taking a toll and a price on our children. They see it around them. I think you see, you know, whether it's with mosques or synagogues, we have new anger at a level that is permissible, and I'm not blaming just Trump, but I think there's something about the leadership of a world, and he's a world leader, believe it or not, that is making it okay for us to be beyond unkind. I mean, really violently uncivil, and I worry about that.
Paul, what do you think?
So before I give my hot take, I want to say I also disagree with, I'm going to disagree with everyone. I disagreed with the writer there. In part because this idea that we're going to get rid of it's that purity talk again. We have to go in this direction. We have to go against the neoliberals. We're going to get rid of the neoliberals. We have to have a big tent. You can barely win an election. This is since the last landslide election we've had was 84, I believe, with Reagan. We haven't had an election that was more than a couple of points since then. And so whichever direction you want to go in, you're still building a multi-coalition party. And you have to keep that in mind. So this idea that we're going to get rid of the neoliberals, that's ridiculous. It same way as the conservatives can think we're going to get rid of the moderates in their party. They can't. They need all of them in order to keep winning. And we need all of each other to keep winning. And we're not going to get rid of each other. And then the other part of it is, here's my hot take. I honestly think we can survive another 4 years of Trump.
You do? Okay.
I don't want to, but here's why. Mm-hmm. He's so bad at his job. So bad. If he was just had a slight bit of common sense and had people around him that knew what they were doing, that were actually working hard, and they could be devastatingly effective, and they're not. They haven't done that much because he's so bad. It's just a good example. I remember back in 2004 when W was trying to win re-election, they were trying to push that constitutional amendment.
Yeah, the Defense of Marriage.
The Defense of Marriage Act. Yeah, that's Trump could Doma. Not. Trump Doma. Could not figure out for the life of him how to pass a constitution. He doesn't know what the Constitution is about. Right. He thinks that it gives him power to shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. He said the Article 2 gives me the power to do whatever I want. You haven't read it. He doesn't know what it means. So he's just so bad. Another one. After Obama was elected back in, I think it was 2010, 2011, when the first wave started of all these different conservative states passing, trying to get rid of all of their abortion clinics in the state and doing all that, was that push going on. You can talk about Karl Rove back in the day, and they were just brilliant at their politics. So they may have been civil, but they were effective at pushing their policies forward. And right now, we've been in almost 3 years now of a president that's just not good. Yes, he may say there are fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, which hurts and sucks and whatever, but I already knew that. Yeah. I already knew that those people existed. They're not new. Yeah. They're just emboldened, but not much has changed, and they haven't been electing a bunch of them. They've at least kept their cloaks on while they're going to Congress. Did I say that out loud? I'm going to stop.
Judicial robes.
Do you have to take a break? Are you okay?
I'm going to give you a little bit of time to respond. I know Patrick wants to weigh in. Yep. And then if you are on the phone, we're going to get our only break of the hour, and we are going to hit your phone calls. But Elaine, go ahead.
So, you know, I agree with you, Paul, about so he's put policies forward in terms of housing and some others that we're just sort of simply able to ignore because there isn't the bandwidth behind it to actually do anything about it. But it still presents a threat. And so, you know, I hear what you're saying, HUD or whatever, you know, we can just sort of ride it out. And we live in New York, so we have some protections and we're going to push back. It's just wrong. Just wrong to settle for, you know, we'll just ignore him and we won't make progress around human rights, about climate control. We won't make progress. We'll just sort of bear with it for another 4 years. I don't think that's okay if you're eight years old and have a life ahead of you.
But just quickly,
I don't think that's okay.
But my pushback was, I think, 4 more years of a Romney would be actually worse than 4 more years of a Trump.
Because he's smarter.
Because he would get it done. That's my point.
Okay.
I just also like, you know, in that world, like, what are you going to do about housing, about climate change, you know, with the Senate constructed the way it is, right? Like, unless, you know, so you need a huge wave landslide next year to even get to 50-50 in the Senate. And then you need to get Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, you know, to vote to abolish the filibuster. And then you need to get every single Democratic senator to vote for stuff. You know, I think the genuine structure of the U.S. government, whether it's the Senate or the Electoral College, also is a significant barrier to these widely popular reforms. And I just think that is a crucially under-discussed piece of this, is that, you know, you don't need massive victories to enact like sweeping progressive legislation. You need like historic, unprecedented victories. And that seems bad.
Yes.
That's right, my take of the day.
Patrick Coyle, Paul Hippolyte, Elaine Spall here talking about what the New York Times and Siena College find is a generational divide among Democrats and their concerns about 1 year from this week when Election Day 2020 happens. And there is a presidential election, congressional election, and a lot more. So we're talking about what the polls mean. It's not just about the horse race. It's about what the sort of what the party priorities are and why. And we'll get your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, author and educator Steve Elner has studied Venezuelan history and politics for decades. He's in Rochester as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America, discussing the crisis in Venezuela and the U.S. government's response. He'll join us in studio. In our second hour, running down the results of the election and the big stories from election night. Talk with you on Wednesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So the new polls from six battleground states are very good news for President Trump. He is more than competitive against some of the leading Democrats. Joe Biden, though, is the Democrat that does the best against Trump in the battlegrounds. And in New York Magazine, John Chait, whom Patrick loves, among others, is saying that this should be a big warning for Democrats to move to the middle and not ignore what the polling says. The election is not going to be won in the popular vote. It's going to be won in the Electoral College. So we're a year away on this 2019 election day. And Patrick works with Citizen Action of New York. Paul Hippolyte is a political strategist. Elaine Spall is soon to be an ex-member of Rochester City Council. But we're always glad to get her perspective. And let's get your phone calls. Eric in Rochester first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, so my problem is, obviously, I mean, being moderate is great and all, but at the end of the day, you realize you're compromising your own values, especially when you see that Republican Democrats are pretty much similar in a lot of aspects with regards, with, you know, without being the same as when it comes to social. When it comes to financials, they're almost the same. Economic policies are very similar. They haven't really changed. And so the biggest problem is, like, I just don't think we need to keep going and doing this all to ourselves every time we keep going through this every political cycle. So, you know, I think it's time to take a stand and actually say, you know what, I'm not for some ideology of one party or another, and for somebody who actually embraces my values. You know what I'm saying? So that's my take on it. So,
Eric, thank you for calling. Eric is fired up, and it's a good reminder that it's a good thing we have a delay and a dump button. And to all guests and callers, please watch your language. But Eric is fired up, and how do you feel about what you heard from Eric, Paul Hippolyte? The listeners didn't hear the word you heard because we have a delay, so they don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's okay.
But the gist of the phone call is that if you're a moderate, you're compromising your values. Paul?
Every piece of legislation is a compromise. There is no perfect legislation, which is why I prefer the campaign side versus the government side. Because I tell this to everyone who listens. I worked in government, and you can come up with the greatest idea, and then you'll have all the reasons why it can't happen or all the ways that it could be done, and all the people you have to compromise with to get something done. And then by the time it's done, you don't even like what you have to push for.
You've
anymore.
Got like a $6,000 deductible,
and now you got to defend it for the next 2 to 4 years,
and, no
and you don't even
option.
Like it. And that's but Obama is a really good example of this. He said, "I will take half a loaf versus no loaf,"
right.
And you have some people on the purity side that prefer no loaf, and I like to eat, so I prefer half a loaf. And the idea that you don't compromise means that you don't want democracy. You don't want a government. That's the basis of our government. And so, yes, you may want to take a strong position one way or the other, but at the end of the day, everyone is going to compromise. And to a certain extent, if you believe in government, we're all moderates.
Okay, so on that point, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm not even sure I believe this, but part of my job is to kind of push a little here. So let's take the half a loaf analogy here. If there's a proposal for a full loaf, everybody eats, and you're saying, well, we got to compromise, got to have half a loaf. But you know that when you compromise, The only people who get to eat the half a loaf are the same people who've been eating for decades, and the same people who don't get to eat, don't ever get to eat. Maybe your decision is, I'm going to keep fighting until we get the full loaf. Mm-hmm. That half a loaf or no loaf, all those people still starve. And then I'm tired of it.
That is a good analogy.
It's a great analogy.
What I will say for that is moving the goalpost or moving the ball down the field, to use another analogy, is, I guess, that's the point. And that legislation is very rarely is going to be all or nothing. And saying, like, okay, well, let's grow the amount of people that have health care. Are there some people that are left out? Yes. But is it better that some people have health care than no one has, than those people, than they not having health care? And I get it that usually the policies we're talking about usually are aimed at middle-class voters, yeah. And you're leaving out people on the poorer end of the spectrum that are going to be left out of that pie. And so, yes, it's how do you keep growing that? And so
it's, even if it's incremental gains.
I guess the... Yes. Yeah. I guess my answer would be yes, but then also you'd have to take a situation by situation.
No,
so
I know that.
There's
that's
some
fair.
Things that
that's
it's
fair.
Like, okay, well, same-sex marriage, there's no half a loaf of that.
I got you, but you're saying pragmatically, generally speaking, you're seeing a little bit too much on the purity test side. It's all or nothing.
Yes, I'll take Joe Biden. I'll take Elizabeth Warren. I'll take Bernie Sanders. I'll take Buttigieg,
Tulsi Gabbard.
Whoa, any of them over Trump? Because
I didn't think you would say Tulsi
with
Gabbard.
Any
John
of them,
Delaney gang.
With any of them, I'm getting at least half of a loaf. Right. That's
okay.
My point.
Okay.
You know, we've been talking a lot about inclusive and diversity and equity and inclusion. Somebody said to me, inclusion is like the way we're doing it right now, is that it's a big tent and everyone gets invited to the party, but only some people are asked to dance. And I think that's the danger. The tent is big, everyone's been invited, but really still only some people get to go to the front and, you know, dance and really be actively engaged. And that's the danger. For many of us, looking after folks and supporting folks who have been constantly left out has been our life's work. And so it's hard. But compromise doesn't need to be a dirty word. I think that's one of the problems. Compromise, and I'm with Paul on this. Paul and I need to spend more time together offline. Yeah.
Thank you.
Patrick, I like you too. I'm sorry. Patrick's feeling left behind. I'm sorry. No. Patrick, you too. I'll buy you guys a coffee. I don't drink alcohol, but you can have a beer.
Me
but
neither.
You know, the point is that compromise may not need to be a dirty word, and I don't know that it's what any of us would want. Because we are progressive, we are revolutionaries, we are trying to transform. But there are times when you got to take a baby step, 2, 3, 4, 5, because there are people who are every single day being left out. So,
I thought of a better analogy now. Because after working in government, you realize that there's so many things that you can, and I'm sure, Elaine, you can speak to this. There's so many things you can do to affect people's lives. They're not big. They're not sexy. They're not.
Right.
And so we make it the Medicare for all or nothing.
Right.
It's either Green New Deal or nothing.
Right.
And it's like, well, how about we increase the minimum wage? Right. How about we decide
that. We ban the box.
We ban the box. There's so many things that are not cool.
Things.
And that those are all the little things you can do to affect the actual everyday lives of people that have a huge impact. And but we don't talk about those. And all of those, in a good example, making sure that people know far enough in advance when their schedule is going to be up, so when they have to go to work, so they can plan around daycare and going to the doctor and going to laundry, like something as simple.
Why do you
like
oppose those things?
Would
Patrick? Have.
I don't think I'm out here arguing against compromise, right? Like I just, you know, I think we're all underselling the difficulty of compromising in 2019. You know, mm-hmm.
That's an interesting point. So what you're saying is even if you think to compromise where it's at, we're not in a Washington that compromises.
No, neither party has any advantage to compromise with the other, right? Because they know that meaningful legislation getting passed always helps the president, whoever. It is. And, you know, like both legislative branches are mostly campaign arms now, you know, and then there's no reason to pretend otherwise.
So you might as well go for it.
Yeah. That's really my point of view. And I would be happy to see any of those things. You know, I'd be happy. But like, what was the last major incrementalist piece of legislation we got, you know, under any president? You know, maybe VA choice in 2014 under Obama or
Obamacare. Incrementalist.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
But again, you know, that's
pretty good.
That's going on 11 years ago now.
Marriage?
Right?
How about equal marriage? That was a
Supreme Court decision.
That might have been more all or nothing.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
All or nothing, but yeah.
I'm criticizing Congress here, not Obama. Nobody call in and yell at me.
Obama is not above criticism. Sorry, Democrats.
But I also think there's very little.
Preaching to the choir here.
I think there's very little that Obama did that I would not see as a compromise. I think all of his legislation.
He was a pragmatist.
They were all, not him being a pragmatist. I'm saying in order to pass anything, you have to compromise.
Yes.
But so those are all compromises.
Are we ever going to get compromise in 2019, right? The House has passed the House has passed a minimum wage bill. The House has passed a, expansion of voter rights bill. But the Republican Senate is just like, that would hurt us politically. So they're not even going to even bother taking it up.
I disagree with you. Last year, the budget, it was a compromise.
Yeah, okay,
in
I
order
can see
to
that.
Pass, every year when we pass the budget, you have some things that the Democrats like that they got through. Including
that.
The money that did not go to funding the border wall.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that's
right.
Majority of what any government does, whether the city council,
county ledge,
the New York State Assembly and Senate, or Congress, most of what they do is actually the budget. And that's where you set your priorities. And so every year, if you want to take that argument, well, every year there is a huge compromise that happens in order to keep this country running.
Yeah, but
sometimes I'll take the ban the box for just a second. The kind of drama pushback we got when we were voting on it never really came to fruition in a reality when we implemented.
Mm-hmm.
All those people, so we're going to be wasting all this time interviewing people who don't deserve to work here, and with our housing, the kind of things we did around housing, and we refused to let people or Section 8 not at least, apply for a market rate. There wasn't the kind of implementation angst that we thought was going to. So again, fear, worrying about things that actually never happened, trying to keep things status quo. We, as long as we live in a zero-sum world, where if I'm better, you've got to be worse. I just can't buy it. I can't abide by it. I might run for office. I don't know. But it makes me crazy that we have to live in a zero-sum. I want you all to do better. I want every single child. I don't want just my children to do better. And that's what I think we've got to get around. We've got to figure out how to get a bigger tent, a real big tent.
If I could.
Are most of those major policies you talked about aimed at improving the lives of everyone, no matter the socioeconomic status? I mean, those are literally rising tide lifts all boat policies.
But when you talk about compromise is the way of Washington, Teresa writes to essentially point out that even if you look at the Affordable Care Act, sometimes it's compromise with Democrats compromising with conservative Democrats.
Yeah.
So she writes, when the guests say they'll vote for anyone that's the nominee, I just wonder how far that goes. Where is the line? Just when someone says they're a Republican or a Democrat, what about the Blue Dogs, the Joe Manchins of the world? Is that the center that we are being encouraged to move toward? What if someone like that were running? Where's the line? What about their issues on war economics? Mm-hmm. What exactly is the line? Is it just someone with a D next to
easy,
the name.
Easy yeah. answer. I would vote for Joe Manchin over Donald Trump. Yes. But what's the point?
Once you're past that thorny issue, though, right? Like the Democratic guy in Louisiana who signed a 6-week abortion ban. Like, is he still under the big tent?
Yeah, he is. He is.
All right,
not
guys,
so much under
call,
my. Not
is.
So much. He might
yeah,
be.
You guys
a
can call me a crazy Twitter leftist if you want. But.
Yeah, but I'm,
is, you're saying
I'm not.
No.
I'm
you're
not
you're
by,
saying you'd prefer
no.
the Republican in Louisiana
yeah,
over him.
And that's the tough part.
That's
right?
My it's, point.
Yeah,
you don't. So he is under the
but
big tent.
But Teresa's
he
point
is.
Was the Zell Millers of the world. Zell Miller, a Georgia Senate Democrat, former governor, who famously said after 9/11, stood on the floor in the Capitol and screamed, bomb the hell out of them in Afghanistan. I don't care who dies, bomb the hell out of them. And then he supported George W. Bush's reelection. He effectively became a Republican. He had a D next to his name. And Teresa's saying, is it anybody with a D? Now, Paul is saying anybody with a D in this election.
I'm saying you're going to have to compare the choices. So if those are your only two choices, then yes, you're going to go with the non-Trump choice if that person is better.
It's any non-Trump choice.
No,
it would have to be comparing the choices.
Yes,
but a non-Trump choice that's worse than Trump, well, then the answer is no, but...
Yeah, I got you.
Evan, in the New York Times magazine,
you sent
the New York Times magazine or the New York magazine to us.
Yep.
There's a part near the end, I actually read it, that said, I'm just going to stay home. I'm going to stay... Did you see that? That people said they'd rather stay home than vote for Elizabeth Warren. They're not going to vote for Trump. Did you see that in the article?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's like the people who would vote for Biden, but not Elizabeth Warren. Like, who?
Yeah, like I think
who's going to stay home?
Yeah.
But I think
yeah,
that I think if that person who's going to bomb everybody was a Democrat and was, I'm not sure what I would do. To be honest with you,
here's
it's tough. It's a really tough one.
It would be tough. But here's my other larger point to that. There is no candidate that agrees with me on almost anything. My views are actually pretty far out there on almost every issue.
We sort of knew that.
I compromise
but it's okay.
On every single issue.
Yeah.
Almost any issue you can bring about, I'd probably say, yeah, I don't. If in my ideal world, I would not even agree to that. So I already feel like I'm compromising on every issue. Mm-hmm. And so now it's just who gets the ball down the field a little bit further. How can we continue to improve on this project that we have? So one day we get closer to what I'm thinking about. But I mean, most of the topics, most of my positions, I don't talk about it on the air. I definitely don't talk about it publicly because people would think I'm absolutely nuts, and it's fine. I could be, but I understand that I don't live alone in this world.
Teresa
and
had
that
a good
I'm going to have community,
I think Teresa had a good
I need
point.
A compromise.
I don't know Teresa, but she had a good point.
Well, two more things here. I'm going to get an email and then more phone calls. Michael says the most pertinent reason why we can't have 4 more years of this administration is the makeup of the Supreme Court. RBG is not getting any younger. Must be a Dem. Have a lovely day.
But again,
from Mike.
If there's not a Dem Senate,
God bless you, Mike.
If there's not a Dem Senate, there's much chance of me being the next president. There is that a Republican-controlled Senate lets any Democratic president for the rest of time.
I think that might be a stretch. We haven't seen that yet. So I think until we see that. I think that
maybe
might
I'm being a little cynical.
I think Patrick just announced something, by the way. Just I'm saying.
I'm not 35 yet.
All right. Back to the phone.
A few years.
Braggard.
Let me get in Rochester. This is Eloise. Go ahead, Eloise.
Hi. I'm calling. First of all, I just want to say I'm going to be 75 in January, and I'm for Bernie's values.
Hell yeah.
And I say this because I've been on the cause for.
Oh, I lost Eloise there. Oh, Eloise is gone. So Eloise told our screener she's been working on a cause for 30 years and nothing has changed. Her hands are tied and she feels at this point, at 75 years old, nothing can or will change. Are you worried that you're going to be 75 and feel the same, Patrick?
No, you never see super tall old people. I'll be fine.
Was that sarcastic?
That was
oh,
sarcastic.
No. When was the last time you saw an old person my size? I'm serious.
Oh, you're saying you're not going to live
that
long.
Yeah, the actuarial tables after age 50 is just right into them.
How tall are you?
It's about 6'10", 6'11".
Oh, 6'10". Okay, so, but the bottom line is if you live to 75, are you worried you're going to look back and say nothing changed?
Yes, of course. So that's why I'm doing what I can to get involved and get involved in local races and, you know, make sure local candidates reflect the values I want to see. And hopefully enough people do that all around the country that it filters out, you know. I mean, that's the only way you can recently affect change. You know, we saw it with the Tea Party. We saw it with all the movements. It starts out at the grassroots level and then it filters up from there.
Edward says, on Presidential Inauguration Day, January 2021, Joe Biden will be 3 months older than Ronald Reagan was on the day that he left the office of the presidency. I'm a 61-year-old white male never-Trumper. I like Joe Biden. He's a guy that I would want to have a beer with at a picnic. I feel he is a decade too old to occupy the Oval Office. I feel the same way about Bernie. Elizabeth Warren, on the other hand, is a force of nature. She exhibits the physical and intellectual stamina of a person 20 years younger than her actual age. That's from Edward. The age question is going to be a question if Joe Biden is the nominee, but it's not just the age question. I don't mean to offend anybody. I don't remember the last time I watched an interview or a debate with him in which he got through sentences without constantly stumbling. I am worried about that, and I realize that that's going to invite some criticism from people. I think he's a remarkably smart person. No one can rise to the ranks of vice president without being remarkably impressive. But yes, Jimmy Carter himself said he thinks Joe Biden might be too old.
So what is the skill set we want? I mean, obviously debating.
And by the way, let me correct this.
Yeah.
Not too old. You could be too old at 60 and you could be too old at 100.
Right.
And you could be young enough at 100 and young enough at any age.
Yeah.
It's a matter of cognitive aptitude. Yeah. It's a hard job.
Or maybe it's just not, he's just not as articulate in terms of those kinds of venues. And I don't know, those of us who have a lot of time speaking and kind of feel like we do a pretty good job at it may have a skill set that we don't have somewhere else. So maybe that's not his strongest suit. And he happens to be in a forum right
now.
He has declined as
a public speaker.
Yeah. Well... You know, he's wearing out. Maybe he's wearing out a little bit, and he's weary of it. I mean, I don't know. What do I know? I'm not a doctor.
Sounds like you're talking about a shoe, not a person running for president. That's a problem.
I'm not taking
this one. That also just worked in government for a little bit. You're not hiring that person. You're hiring a team.
That's
exactly.
A great point.
Exactly.
Compare him to Trump. Trump does not get through many sentences, even on Twitter, when he has a chance to sit and edit himself.
Exactly. Thank you, Paul.
And so you're voting for an entire team, and I believe that if we voted for Joe Biden, he would actually have a press secretary. I think he would have a real ambassador to Ukraine and not a crony that is running a shadow foreign government policy.
Right.
I think that he would have people that are sensible in those positions, and I would trust that any day of the week over Donald Trump. And if he was no longer able to do the job, I think they would get someone else that's also reasonable to fill out the rest of his term.
But also, we're in a primary. You know, I mean, nobody's forcing us to pick a candidate right now, you know, like, and so I think we're all getting a bit over our skis here, you know, and I just don't think there's any reason other than to, you know, evaluate all the candidates and what they say and how they seem and their policy positions, just vote for whoever you want. You know, I think even talking about general election matchups, you know, I mean, what, we've got probably like 95 days until votes are cast in Iowa.
I can't believe that we got to the end of the program and I forgot to say what I meant to say at the outset, which is that when Howard Dean was leading in the polls, we all knew it was going to be John Kerry. Just like right now, we all know it's going to be Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, big time.
And can I also say...
I'm going to make a prediction.
In 2008, there were a lot of people who were very nervous. America is not ready to elect a black president.
That's right.
Yes.
What's the gentleman from California that the famous effect is called? Whatever. The Bradley effect. People are talking about that.
Yeah.
And so this idea that we can't elect a woman, I think we're too early for that.
I want to go on record and say Adam Schiff's going to rise up. Adam Schiff, the guy from California. Do you know him?
For president?
I think he's going to rise up. You don't like him, but I like him.
Elaine.
Patrick's giving himself like
gotta
a not ever. We got to go. Okay.
Who's going to be the nominee?
Patrick Kennedy.
Oh.
From Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
I think it'll be Warren.
No, I'm with Warren, too.
I got to go with Biden. I know how you feel. I don't care.
It's not about how I feel.
Thank you,
Listen,
Evan.
Thank you for the conversation. Paul Hippolyte, Patrick Coyle, Elaine Spall. Our thanks to David Griffin, Rob Braden Engineering, Megan Mack Producing. I'm Evan Dawson. 9 p.m. tonight for the 2019 election coverage. I will talk to you live then.